Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. David Pinsoff. He's a research scientist at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles, and his research focuses on evolutionary psychology, political psychology, public opinion, and sexual behavior. And today we're focusing mostly on political belief systems, the meaning of life, morality, and some other related topics. So, David, welcome to the show. It's a big pleasure to have you on.
The pleasure is all mine, Ricardo. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and I'm very happy to be on it.
Great, thanks. So, starting with the fun stuff, let's talk about political belief systems then. So, I mean, I guess that if you talk with political scientists and philosophers when it comes to explaining how political belief systems work, where they come from, they would give you a, I don't know, a highly intellectualized version of it based on abstract values and how they are so coherent and so on. But since you come from an evolutionary psychology perspective, how do you approach it exactly?
I have a kind of cheeky blog called Everything is Bullshit, and part of the shtick there is to call bullshit on things. And you could describe my academic paper, Strange Bedfellows, The Alliance Theory of Political Belief Systems, as a way of calling bullshit on that prevailing view of political ideology. I really take aim at the idea that liberalism or conservatism, as they manifest in contemporary American society or other Western nations, represent coherent belief systems, reflect moral principles, reflect well-thought-out philosophies. I think they are much more strategic, chaotic, random than that. And I'd be happy to get into the details of how I'm grounding out that view.
Okay, so, but just before we get into your view and start exploring it, what would you say are some of the most common explanations that people bring to the table when trying to explain where political belief systems come from?
I'd say broadly speaking, the most common approach to political belief systems is to point to some essential difference between people on either side of the political spectrum. So maybe that essential difference has to do with one's personality or one's psychological dispositions, one's traits, one's personal idiosyncrasies and quirks, the way one sees the world. And that's one common way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is to say that they really pertain to differences in moral values. So one of the most prominent approaches in this area is Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations theory, which says that liberals and conservatives rely on different moral foundations. That is, liberals have a monomaniacally egalitarian and harm-focused ideology, whereas conservatives rely on all six moral foundations, from in-group, out-group psychology to purity and authority. And roughly, I think a lot of people in political psychology would agree that there are deep-seated moral differences between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, left-wing, right-wing, etc. And it's those abstract moral values that color and explain the contents of our political belief systems. They are the common thread that ties all our beliefs together, and I think that is mistaken.
And what would you say are some of the biggest weaknesses, at least in your view, when it comes to hypotheses that are based on or try to explain political belief systems on the basis of abstract values? Because, I mean, it seems to me that sometimes people are trying to talk about abstract values and not necessarily just moral values, but some other sorts of political values. As if they were like sort of separate from the rest of our psychology and based on just pure rational philosophy or something like that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Sure, I think the biggest problem with that view is that it's just fundamentally evolutionarily implausible. So if you actually look at what people who believe in these abstract values are saying, usually what they're saying is that these values are not self-interested. They're not helping a person advance their power or status or access to resources. They're not in the interests of one's self or one's kin. But they're also not group interested either, because if they were, then we would strategically endorse whatever values support our political allies and reject them or flout them when they serve the interests of our political rivals. And when we have a wide variety of heterogeneous political allies, as we do in modern democracies with complex political coalitions, then we're going to see the strategic endorsement of moral values in one case to support one's allies, and the rejection of that moral value when it happens to support our rivals. And so that is basically identical to alliance theory, that these values are not really held consistently, but are used strategically to support the interests of one's allies and oppose the interests of one's rivals. But the problem is, if these abstract values are not in our self-interest and they're not in our political allies' interests or our group's interests, then that really rules out the only possible mechanisms by which these values could have evolved. Darwin once famously said that something along the lines of things don't exist merely for the sake of beauty or for the sake of mere variety. They don't exist to delight man or the creator, right? And if you could show that the properties of an animal exhibited these benevolent properties, then that would be absolutely fatal to the theory of evolution. And I think a lot of people in political psychology are taking that kind of evolutionarily implausible view that we have these high-minded values that are nobly designed to make the world a better place, but that's just not the kind of thing that can evolve by natural selection. And so I think we actually need to get a bit more cynical about our supposed moral values, in the same way that we're cynical about the mission statements and PR campaigns of big corporations. I don't think anyone thinks that Starbucks's actual goal is to nourish and inspire the human spirit, as it says on their website. I think most people, when trying to predict what Starbucks is going to do next, are going to ask themselves what will make Starbucks the most money. And I think we need to view humans in a similar way. I think we need to view the quote-unquote mission statements of political design to mobilize supporters. And they, we really have no reason to think that they represent nobly designed, impartially altruistic worldviews. I think that's fundamentally, evolutionarily and functionally implausible.
And a very interesting question here is if people's political beliefs are even consistent. That is, and of course, that might mean different things, but I guess that what people mean by consistent here is that, for example, if someone says they are from the left or from the right or a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian, an authoritarian, or something like that, there's sort of a checklist, and they check all the points when it comes to the political beliefs that you usually associate with either side of the political spectrum. But I mean, there are, I guess, very good criticisms of that. For example, back in 2018, I interviewed Robert Kurzban, and he has a very good book about that, and he sort of shows, I think, to some extent, that people are not really consistent, at least if we look at things from a, I mean, expecting that people again check all of the boxes when it comes to a particular political ideology. And there are things that perhaps, even if I, for example, identify as a Republican, I might agree with some points, on some points with the Democrats and vice versa. So are people's political beliefs really consistent or not?
So it's a complicated question in that I think the way that a lot of political scientists think about consistency is misguided. So a lot of political scientists will think that, if you support, say, Christian fundamentalist morality, anti-abortion, anti-recreational drugs, anti-gay rights, and you also endorse free market libertarianism, that is a consistent moral philosophy. And if you, insofar as you deviate from that, then you're inconsistent. And I think that is just a very wrong-headed way of thinking about what it means to be consistent. I think we should define consistency in the straightforward way of having beliefs that fit together coherently. And if you actually look at the combination of Christian fundamentalism and free market libertarianism, there's actually nothing consistent about it at all. The only reason these philosophies go together in the United States is because of a historically contingent political alliance that arose in starting in the 1970s between wealthy business people and pro-life evangelicals. And that alliance does not exist in many other countries. In fact, in other countries, you see free market libertarianism being combined with more secular ideology, with being pro-choice. And so this peculiar alliance that exists in the United States is not a reflection of some deep, feature of human nature that these issues have to go together. I think they are much more historically contingent and arbitrary than we like to think. And so I don't think that political belief systems are consistent in the sense of reflecting coherent philosophies or consistently held moral principles. And I go through a lot of examples in the paper of ideological inconsistencies that are really hard to explain from that perspective, but easy to explain from my perspective.
Okay, but wait a minute, because at this point, someone might come in and say, okay, but perhaps that's true for just the general population. I mean, the average citizen, the average voter is ignorant, is ill-informed, they don't inform themselves about the politics, about the political philosophy, the political science, they don't read, blah, blah, blah. And so that's the main reason why they say they are, for example, on the right, but they have inconsistent beliefs. They might believe in some things that are mostly associated with the left and so on, and vice versa as well. But what about the, let's call them political elites, and that would include, of course, the more, let's say, educated people, the people who actually read the political philosophy, the political science, and they want to try to be, or they say they want to try to be as consistent as possible, and they are constantly informing themselves on the politics, what's happening, and so on, the political alliances and all of that. I mean, are political elites, the more educated people, the more informed people, more consistent than just the general population?
Yeah, so that's generally the standard view in political science, which is that the masses are generally uninformed, or at the very least not as well informed as their elite counterparts, and they sort of lack quote unquote ideological consistency, and the dominant explanation for mass opinion is that it's group centric. That is, it's rooted in sort of group attachments, group prejudices, group allegiances, and their policy preferences really depend on, whether the policy is benefiting groups they like or groups they don't like. And if it's benefiting a group they like, then they like the policy. And if it's benefiting a group they don't like, then they don't like it. And that's really the dominant approach to explaining the political beliefs of the mass public. And what's interesting is that the group attitudes of the mass public do not necessarily align with the group attitudes of political elites. That is, they're much more chaotic and unpredictable. What I want to argue is that the political beliefs of elites are in fact just as group-centric as the political beliefs of the mass public. It is just that the groups around which they center are a different set of groups. And the beliefs might be a more sophisticated set of rationalizations befitting of more intelligent, highly educated people. But that's really the only difference. That is, you see these complex political coalitions and alliances, and the most politically informed people are most attentive to the details of those political coalitions and are most willing to align themselves with those coalitions and accommodate new alliances and oppose the enemy of their enemy and befriend the ally of their ally. And that kind of loyalty and engagement is what ultimately drives their beliefs, their loyalty to the coalition as a whole, not any kind of abstract philosophizing. Usually the abstract philosophizing comes as a justification or rationalization for whatever serves the interests of their political coalition.
So we've been focusing mostly on people here, but talking about the belief systems themselves, and of course here again we are coming from the presupposition that there is a pure ideological belief system from any sort of ideology here, which is also something questionable or debatable, but are even the belief systems themselves coherent? Because someone might say, oh, okay, so you're saying, or earlier you talked about the example of some ideological inconsistencies when it comes to, for example, Republicans in the US, but people might say, oh, okay, but that's just a silly historical accident, but they're still pure right-wing ideology out there somewhere. And when you look at it, and if you're careful, you can see that it's really coherent. But is that really the case?
Yeah, so I think it's not the case. And you could go through any feature you want to identify with, say, right-wing ideology or left-wing ideology. I go through three different proposed features in the paper, equality, authority, and tolerance. And I go through each feature and show how the apparent moral principle or moral value is actually not held consistently. And it's only brought forward when it's in the interests of one's political allies, and it is flouted and rejected when it happens to benefit other groups, especially one's political rivals. So to take an example from the equality domain, liberals think it is unfair that corporate CEOs make millions of dollars a year, but they actually think it's fair for Hollywood movie stars to make millions of dollars a year. And so that would be an example of the type of ideological inconsistency I'm talking about, especially when you consider the fact that corporate CEOs are widely associated with conservatives and Hollywood movie stars are widely associated with liberals. And what's interesting is that you actually see the reversal among conservatives. Conservatives actually think that it's unfair for Hollywood movie stars to make millions of dollars a year. And so as soon as you swap in different groups that people feel allegiance or rivalry towards, you see their supposed principles shift and change flexibly. Another example from the equality domain, we like to think that conservatives don't care about disadvantaged groups, but when you say, should the government do more to help small working class towns in America's heartland, that is very much a right-wing coded group, and a majority of conservatives say, yes, the government should do more to help them. So it's really not a matter of being in favor of quality, of equality or inequality in the abstract or in general. It's really being strategically in favor of it when it favors the interests of one's allies, and being strategically against it when it favors the interests of one's rivals. And I'm happy to go through some of the other supposed principles as well, if you'd like me to.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I was just about to ask you, because there's this idea that whatever sort of principles are part of a specific political ideology, I mean, the ideology itself derives from supposed first principles. That is something that philosophers, for example, talk a lot about. And in this particular case, I guess that some political scientists would also argue that. But, I mean, you're making the case here that that's not really the case. They are based, or these ideologies are based on things like ad hoc justifications, rationalizations, moralizations, and so on. So perhaps tell us a little bit more about that, and if you have a few more examples to illustrate this point.
Sure. So we can go through the idea authoritarianism. Another widely proposed view is that right-wing ideology is all about respecting authority or obeying authority or enforcing one's preferences on others. And that just does not make a lot of sense at all. So if you ask, you know, conservatives whether we ought to respect authority more, you know, most of them would say yes. But then if you ask them if companies should disobey government regulations that they think are unfair, a majority of them will also say yes. So that's another example of an inconsistency. So conservatives are happy to say they support authority in the abstract, but when it comes to specific authorities, like, I don't know, the IRS, the CDC, the EPA, the WHO, government regulators, Democratic politicians, even the FBI, once they started investigating Donald Trump, many Republicans turned against. These are a wide variety of authorities that Republicans reject and disrespect. So I think it is very hard to argue that they are holding a case. And if you think that it's about exercising authority over others, I think that's also hard to reconcile with their actual opinions, which involve, you know, deregulating businesses, environmental deregulation, having fewer restrictions during COVID-19. These are hard to reconcile with a general desire to exercise authority over others. And if you look at the desire to exercise authority over others in terms of restricting their speech, you actually see little to no differences at all between liberals and conservatives. That is, people want to restrict the speech of their political opponents, but not their political allies. And you see that on both sides of the political spectrum. If anything, there might be a little bit of evidence that that is more prominent on the left these days. So I think it's hard to argue that authority or a general desire to obey or exercise authority is the unifying principle of right-wing ideology. So the other one is tolerance. So that would be a kind of tribalism or nationalism or ethnocentrism that is supposed to be more prevalent among right-wing people. And I think there that's equally at odds with reality. So if you ask conservatives whether we ought to be more suspicious and distrusting of foreigners, most of them will say yes. But then when you ask if we should trust Vladimir Putin when he said that he did not interfere in the 2016 election, a majority of them will also say yes. So that's quite a stark inconsistency there. That is, they think we should be distrusting of foreigners, but when it comes to a particular foreigner who is a Russian autocrat and hostile, overtly hostile to the United States, they seem to trust him quite readily. And so I think that is one of many stark inconsistencies you see on the right. And I think it's I list a few other examples in the paper, but. You could also see similar inconsistencies on the left. That is, the left will say that they value, you know, diversity and respecting the views of a variety of different groups. But in fact, they disrespect the views of any group that is mildly associated with conservatives. So Christian fundamentalists, pro-life people, white people, men, wealthy business people, these days even pro-Israeli people. So the respect for diversity is actually pretty restricted to a list of groups that are left coded.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm not sure if these what I'm about to say makes sense or not. If it doesn't, please correct me in whatever way you think it makes sense. But I mean, even when it comes to some of the supposed principles, or at least the labels people come up with sometimes to refer to some of their values that supposedly orient their political ideology. I mean, sometimes with the same label, people from different sides mean different things, and they're also inconsistent within their own ideology. But just to talk about different sides meaning different things, for example, when it comes to economics, perhaps someone on the left, when they use the word freedom, or they would bring the word freedom to the table when saying, okay, so perhaps workers should be paid enough, should earn enough to cover at least their basic expenses and to feel secure enough in their own lives. I mean, if they work, for example, full time, they should earn enough to cover their bills and not being ejected from their homes and stuff like that. And perhaps they might use the word freedom there in the sense of not being economically coerced, for example. But when it comes to the right, perhaps they would use the word freedom to refer more to things like, in the case of more libertarian right-wingers, they want a more deregulated market, and that's freedom for them. So, I mean, that's also you're making in the sense that, okay, so people use these words, they refer to principles, but even then, they use it very, sometimes very loosely, because in a particular situation, freedom means one thing, in another situation, it means another thing, and even the supposed meaning that, in this particular case, freedom might have for leftists and right-wingers, if you look across different examples, perhaps they are not so much on the side of their own flavor of freedom, but they are more authoritarian and so on. So, does this also make sense or not?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's a great example of the point I'm making, which is that it doesn't really make sense to say that one ideology is the ideology of freedom, given that each political coalition is trying to use freedom to mobilize support for its side. That is, freedom is a word that has a lot of positive vibes. If you ask people if they like freedom, I bet you that most people will say, yeah, freedom's great. And so each party is basically competing to capture the positive vibes of freedom to mobilize support for their side. But whether each side actually consistently holds the principle of freedom is a different question. And I think the answer to that question is no, they don't. What they're trying to do is use freedom as a kind of mission statement to associate their political coalition with positive vibes. But I don't think it represents a coherent and principled philosophy. Because if it were, you would see each side, valuing freedom in all cases. But that is not what you see. Another example of this kind of competition for positive and negative vibes, I think, is really clear in the abortion debate. You see, people who oppose abortion, they describe themselves as pro-life. That is, they're trying to paint themselves as the group that values life, right? They're trying to put a positive spin on their view, and in the same way, people on the pro-choice side are trying to claim the mantle of freedom, that a woman should have the right to do what she wants with her own body. But of course, neither side holds this principle actually consistently. People who are pro-life are happy to be pro-death when it comes to civilian casualties, when it comes to military occupations, when it comes to the death penalty. When it comes to contraception, which could actually prevent abortions. On the left, most liberals will say that a woman should have the right to do what she wants with her own body, unless she wants to, say, purchase private health insurance, or not wear a seatbelt, or drink a large sugary soda, or have sex for money. These are all views that are pretty common on the left, and they are pretty inconsistent with the idea that we should generally have the right to do what we want with our own bodies. That would be my case there.
Yeah, and I brought that to the table. I mean, people basically using the same term or referring to the same principle but with different meanings, because sometimes in political debates, political discussions, it's very obvious, at least for someone looking on the outside, from the outside, that people are using the same term but with completely different meanings, like in this case, freedom and the examples high and you gave here. But perhaps what I was alluding to there by bringing that discussion here to the table is that, is it really about the word or the principle freedom, or since you're using it to refer to completely different things, isn't it really about you having a particular kind of interest, of you wanting to do something or wanting other people to do something as well? Or not do for in particular cases, and then simply attaching the label freedom to it just because it sounds good to try to convince other people, for example.
Yeah, I think it's very much the latter, and I think it's directly analogous to the marketing and PR you see in the corporate world. Corporations will have mission statements, they have values that they are supposedly pursuing, and because it is in their financial interest to associate positive vibes with their brand, right? Starbucks says their mission is to inspire and nurture the human spirit. I'm sure you could come up with equally silly examples from other large corporations, and I think there is an interesting element there, which is that in order to make money, you have to convince people that you're not interested in making money, and I think that's what I would call a social. But I think you see the exact same phenomenon in the political world. In order to gain power, you have to convince people that you're not interested in gaining power. That instead, what you're interested in is making the world a better place, generally making things better for everyone, being kind and generous and fair and patriotic and virtuous and all those sunny things. But really, politics is a competition to gain control of the coercive apparatus of the state, which literally forces people to do things by threat of imprisonment. That is a scary thing. And nobody has ever gained power by saying that that's what they want. I want to gain control of the coercive apparatus of the state so that I can boss people around and force them to do things by threat of imprisonment. No one has ever gotten elected by saying that. Just as no business has ever made money by saying, all I want to do is make as much money as possible. I don't care about values or the environment or whatever. So I think we have these social paradoxes, these tensions in our mind that in order to pursue our goals, we cannot admit the goals we're pursuing. And I think we can't even admit them to ourselves a lot of the time. I think a lot of people at Starbucks would probably believe their own bullshit that they really are trying to inspire and nurture the human spirit. And I think most committed partisans and ideologues also believe their own bullshit that they really are trying to pursue this impartially altruistic vision to better humanity in the world.
But when it comes to the social dynamics themselves, so for example, things like social identity and intergroup relations, what aspects of that kind of research would apply here? Because I mean, I read in your paper that you are also trying to reframe, for example, the in-group, out-group dichotomy as an allies versus rivals dichotomy, right? Could you explain that?
Sure. So there's a whole bunch of research on what's called social identity theory, the idea that we have an in-group and we have an out-group, and it's a monolithic in-group and against a monolithic out-group, and they're fixed and they stay the same, and we do things and believe things to make us feel better about our in-group, to enhance our self-esteem, and we do things that make the out-group look worse to enhance our self-esteem. That is the vision coming out of decades of research in social psychology. I think that vision is deeply flawed for a number of reasons. For one thing, if you actually look at the group dynamics in small-scale hunter-gatherer forager societies, it is nothing like the monolithic in-group against the monolithic out-group. It is very much complex strategic rivalries occurring within groups. They're constantly fissioning and fusioning. They're called fission-fusion societies, literally. Like they have small bands of around 20 or 30 people, and then they form larger groups, and then they split apart. And so it's much more complicated and dynamic than the picture of one tribe on one side of the river and another tribe on the other side of the river. I think we are much more politically savvy and sophisticated than this kind of caveman tribalism that has come out of social identity theory. And so what I try to replace this picture with is, instead of talking about in-groups and out-groups, which is misleading in a variety of ways, I think it's more illuminating to talk about alliances, to talk about allies and rivals and conflicts within groups. I can walk you through some of the ways in which this in-group out-group thing breaks down. You might expect that in order to favor a group, you would have to be in that group. They would have to be in your in-group, and in order to oppose a group, they would have to be your out-group. But that's just manifestly not the case. You don't have to be a black person to feel as if you are an ally of black people. And you don't have to be a police officer to feel as if you are an ally of police officers. You don't have to be an Israeli to feel pro-Israel. You don't have to be a Palestinian to be pro-Palestinian. You do not have to be in a group to be an ally of that group. Alliances can occur between groups. And the same thing occurs within groups. You don't have to, you can be a white person and feel enmity toward white people. In fact, a lot of white progressives feel that way about white people. You can be an American and feel negatively toward Americans. Ditto, a lot of progressives hold that view as well. You can be a poor person and feel antipathy toward poor people. You can be a rich person and feel antipathy toward rich people. And these phenomena are much easier to understand when you realize that there are rivalries within groups. That is, within the group of rich people, there are different subcultures. Within the group of poor people, there are different subcultures, perhaps ethnic rivalries between lower class white people and lower class ethnic minorities, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if we view politics from the lens of ever-shifting alliances and rivalries, I think that is going to be a much more illuminating and insightful way of understanding things than in terms of cheering for some monolithic in-group against some monolithic out-group that never changes.
And when it comes to the alliances, how do people form them? I mean, is there a set of criteria that people use to choose their allies?
Yeah, so in the paper, I go over three criteria that people use for choosing allies that have a lot of empirical evidence going for them at the moment. I'm not saying that these are the only three criteria we use, but I think the strongest case could be made that these are important. So the three are similarity, transitivity, and interdependence. So I'll go through each one in turn. Similarity, like attracts like. We like people who are similar to us. People who speak the same language, who speak that language in the same dialect, who inhabit the same location, who share personality quirks, maybe share similar beliefs, share the same skin color, et cetera, et cetera. This is a pretty obvious one, and the evolutionary rationale there is pretty clear. So, for one thing, similarity might help you coordinate and collaborate with an ally. That is, the easiest example of this is if allies speak the same language, they're going to have an easier time working together. But they could also speak the same language of their subculture and have an easier time working together. Or they could have, similar personality quirks, and they might, be less likely to have conflicts and disagreements with one another because they're more similar in that vein. A marker might help to create common knowledge of the alliance itself. That is, you see this in sports, one team wears red shirts, the other team wears blue shirts, and that helps everyone coordinate who's on whose side. We do the same thing with our alliances and rivalries. And I think one of the reasons why racism is so pernicious is because there are visible differences that are common knowledge to everyone in terms of skin color and outward appearance. And that helps make it easier for people to coordinate who's on whose side. The second one is transitivity. So that is summed up by the following statements: the enemy of my enemy is my friend, the friend of my friend is my friend, the friend of my enemy is my enemy, and the enemy of my friend is my enemy. These statements taken together are what I call transitivity, the sharing of allies and enemies. And there are pretty solid functional reasons why we would want transitive allies versus intransitive allies. That is, it mitigates two major costs. One is infighting. That is, we don't want our allies getting into conflicts with one another. Because if they get into conflicts, then we're going to have to be forced to choose sides. We're going to have to be forced to choose between them. And that means we're going to lose one of our allies and potentially gain a new enemy, which is really bad for us. So we want our allies to get along. And we also want our allies to share our enemies because. If an ally is friendly toward our enemies, well, they might side with our enemies and betray us, and that is really bad for us as well. So for that reason, we really we look to transitivity when deciding who we want to ally with and who we don't, and we also try to accommodate new allies by being transitive with them. That is, if we form an alliance, we oppose our allies' enemies. And we support our allies' friends. That's transitivity. Interdependence. This is probably the broadest and most underexplored one, but I think it's perhaps one of the most important ones. This is just generally whether a person or individual benefits you or not, whether they are acting in your self-interest or not. You could think of this in terms of someone acting against your self-interest. Say, if you're competing with someone for status or resources, then you would be negatively interdependent with them, and you would not want to form an alliance with them because it is in your interests to lower their status or to lower their access to resources so that you can get more of those resources for yourself. So that would be a kind of negative interdependence. A positive interdependence would be these people are inclined to help you, to share information with you, to trade with you, et cetera, et cetera. So interdependence are just, a cooperative relationship wherein parties benefit each other either directly or indirectly that is likely to lead to alliances. So those are the three criteria I discuss in the paper.
And of course, when we have alliances, we need, to maintain them, of course, we need to support our allies. And so in the particular context of politics, or at least that's one of the contexts where you see this happening, how do we do that through the use of propagandistic tactics?
So the point of an alliance, from my perspective, is to offer support in conflicts. That is, conflicts is ubiquitous in social life. There are limited resources, like status, power, and resources, and one side's or one person's gain is another side or person's loss. So, in order to prevail in these conflicts, we try to mobilize supporters. We try to draw people to our side so that our side is bigger than the other side and the other side submits to our bigger side. That's the way democracy works. The side with the most votes wins. That's how a lot of conflicts play out in small-scale societies. The bigger side gets their way. And so we have a vested interest in making our side the bigger side. How do we do that? The way we do that is with propaganda. So when a conflict breaks out, we try to frame the conflict and describe it in ways that flatter our allies and impugn our rivals. So I can walk you through the three propagandistic biases I discuss in the paper if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
So the first one is perpetrator biases. So probably the most common source of conflict would be someone committing harm against someone else. And how do you mobilize support for a perpetrator of a transgression against the person they wronged? Well, one way you want to do that is you want to downplay that transgression. You want to minimize it. You want to justify it. You want to rationalize it. You want to emphasize the mitigating circumstances. You want to emphasize their good intentions. They didn't really mean to do anything wrong. You want to frame them as generally a good, well-meaning person, and the victim as being a crybaby, or even making it up altogether. So that's what I would call perpetrator biases. They are extremely common, both when we commit transgressions and when our allies commit transgressions. We bring perpetrator biases to bear on that. The other side of this, of course, is victim biases. Victims have basically the opposite set of biases. So they will view the perpetrator as incredibly personally responsible for committing the harm, no mitigating circumstances, no good intentions. They were just pure evil, twirling their mustaches, and they just wanted to harm us just out of pure sadism. Of course, the harm they committed was incredibly grievous. It will last for generations. We should never forget it. We should always remember this horrible harm that will last forever. Those are victim biases. You could think of it as the exact opposite of perpetrator biases. And then there's another class of interesting biases that relate to conflicts over status and resources. This presumably would also be a recurrent source of conflict in ancestral environments. And the way we resolve these conflicts is by making attributions about the causes of disadvantages and advantages. That is, if we attribute a person's advantages to their internal dispositions, that is, their intelligence, their talent, their wisdom, their creativity, their work ethic, then we're inclined to side with that person and let them have their advantages or their resources. But if a person lost a lot of resources or status through no fault of their own, through misfortune, through bad luck, or through mistreatment or exploitation by others, then we're inclined to side with them and we're inclined to give resources to them and compensate them and help them in whatever way we can. So naturally, if there's a conflict over resources or status, then we're going to want to attribute our high status allies' advantages to their internal dispositions, their smart and hardworking, and our low status allies' disadvantages to external factors. They were just unlucky, or they were preyed upon by exploitative people. And so we have both of these biases, and we employ them depending on whether our allies are in the advantaged position or the disadvantaged position, and we do that in a strategic way. Those are attributional biases.
And so how do we go from the biases you've just described there, and also what we talked about a bit earlier regarding social dynamics and alliances, how do we go from there to political alliance structures, like, for example, let's say a political party?
Yeah. So it just kind of falls naturally out of those those basic assumptions about how our alliance psychology works. So if you just think about, you know, similarity, transitivity, interdependence, and just look at the kind of social groups that form in any given society, you can start to see how this might unfold. So for example, you might get some groups forming based on ethnicity or region. You know, Southerners might have a kind of Southern loyalty, or class, or religion. And from there, you start to think about, well, how are these groups going to coalesce into different alliances? And then you might start thinking about transitivity, and you might start thinking about overlap between groups. So maybe, you know, ethnic minorities are going to overlap with poor people, and so you might get an alliance between the interests of ethnic minorities and the interests of lower class people. And you might see some status rivalries between, you know, members of the upper class, that is the more highly educated elites, and the less educated, wealthy corporate executives. And you might see a rivalry there, with perhaps intellectual elites siding with ethnic minorities and poor people, and with the wealthy business people siding with lower class white people, who might feel rivalrous with their lower class ethnic minority counterparts. That's basically the dynamics of how it plays out. And then from there, once you get this alliance structure, you just straightforwardly apply those propagandistic biases to each member of the alliance structure. And then from there, the contents of political belief systems just fall out perfectly. And you can get a beautiful explanation for all of the inconsistencies and double standards and idiosyncrasies of political belief systems simply by looking at the alliance structure and looking at what beliefs would mobilize support for each member of that alliance structure. And from there, ideologies fall out of that elegantly.
But since from the very beginning of our conversation, we've also been referring to alternative theories, in this case, in the paper, you also go through, for example, intolerance theory, authoritarianism theory, and egalitarianism theory. So could you tell us about those? I mean, how, in what ways they would be alternatives to your alliance theory or political belief systems, and in what aspects do you think they fail?
Sure. So one alternative explanation for the existing alliance structure is that it's all based on equality. And really what you see in the left-wing alliance is just a bunch of low-status disadvantaged groups, and what you see in the right-wing alliance is just a bunch of high-status disadvantaged groups. But if you actually look at the alliance structure, you see that that is not the case. So there are plenty of high-status groups on the left-wing side, like college professors, scientists, government regulators, members of the of international organizations, scientists, etc. And then you also see plenty of low-status groups on the right-wing side. So you see, you know, working-class white people, you know, manufacturing workers, people without a college degree, people in small towns that are struggling. What's interesting is that if you actually measure a group's perceived status and you measure their perceived political allegiances, it turns out that status makes no difference in predicting which group either side of the political spectrum will like or dislike. So this I'm referring here to the work of Mark Brandt, and he measured attitudes toward a variety of different groups, dozens of different social groups in society, measured their status, measured their perceived political allegiances. Turns out the simplest and most elegant and powerful model just uses the group's perceived political allegiances, throws out status, throws out other variables. That basically predicts who you're going to like and dislike. And if you just think about other groups, you know, like there are plenty of groups in the political line structure that don't really seem high status or low status at all. Like, are environmentalists high status? I don't know. Are Christian fundamentalists high status or low status? I don't know. What about Southerners? High status or low status? Not sure. Pro-life people, unclear. Recreational drug users, unclear. Really, I think status is either ambiguous or it violates the rule. So I don't think that equality can really explain contemporary alliance structures, and it certainly can't explain the variation in alliance structures you see around the world and throughout history. So the alliance structures were very different in the past. African Americans used to be quite loyal to the party of Lincoln. Racist segregationist Southerners used to be quite loyal to the Democratic Party. They were known as Dixiecrats. Devout Christianity used to not be a partisan issue at all. So if you look at these alliance structures, there's so much variation across time and space that it's really hard to argue that any principle of equality is organizing them. And then, of course, there are plenty of ideological inconsistencies regarding equality, which I discuss in the paper and which I talked about previously. The other ones, authority and diversity. I basically use the same strategy with those. I go through plenty of ideological inconsistencies where these principles are not held and are often flouted strategically. And yeah, that's basically my beef with egalitarianism, authoritarianism, and tolerance.
So, since you're from the US, do you think that if your theory is correct, it might help us understand or better understand the formation of the Democratic Republican divide you have there?
Yeah, so I present a pretty detailed sketch of how I think this divide originated and where it was, you know, around 100, 150 years ago, and how it has evolved over time. So as I mentioned previously, the current political alliance structure is very different than what it was, you know, 100, 150 years ago at the turn of the 20th century. Christianity and abortion was just not an issue. It was not a divide. Feminism was not a divide between the two parties at the turn of the 20th century. Race was very different. So African Americans were actually leaned in favor of the Republican Party. Racist Southerners were Democrats. I walk through the evolution of that alliance structure and how it has changed. In the paper, and I think you could tell a similar story for how alliance structures have played out in other societies. I think you see some overlaps in similar countries, like countries in Western Europe, and I think that could be explained by just convergences in the types of factors that create alliance structures. So if you have, you know, overlap between highly religious towns. You know, whatever the cause of that overlap, if there's overlap, then groups are going to be more likely to form an alliance and belong to the same political coalition than other groups. And I think you see that convergence in a lot of Western European nations, particularly nations who have had similar political conflicts about globalization and the erosion of religious morality. And it also explains some of the differences, I think. If you look at the unique history of different countries, particularly Eastern European countries who are dealing with the collapse of communism, that has resulted in different alliances. You even there's an interesting example I cite in the paper in Latvia where green parties were actually sort of anti-communist, right-wing nationalist parties because they rose in opposition to Soviet industrial policy. So there are lots of interesting examples of alliance structures that deviate from what you see in America and a few Western nations. I talk about that a lot in the paper and how other theories really struggle to explain it.
And so I would also like to ask you about, I would like to hear your thoughts about moral foundations theory. That's also something that we touched on earlier a little bit. So, what are your thoughts on it and on basically the idea about there being a connection or an intimate connection between certain moral values and also certain corresponding or supposedly corresponding political ideologies? And a second question I have that's related to that is, do you think that the way you're thinking about or reframing the way we think about political belief systems, ethical systems, or not?
First I'll just start off by saying that I'm very skeptical of moral foundations theory as a theory of political differences. So I don't think it can explain why liberals and conservatives have the beliefs they do. I don't think it can even come close to explaining all of the inconsistencies in political ideologies. In fact, it struggles to make sense of them, as I argue in the paper. So I think in terms of a theory of political belief systems, moral foundations theory fails. As a theory of moral cognition, I think it's fine as a first pass. I think the six foundations that he sketched are reasonable hypotheses about cognitive adaptations that might have evolved to solve recurrent problems in cooperation and group living. I personally prefer Oliver Curry's work, which sort of expands upon Jonathan Haidt's work and adds a few additional foundations and gets a little bit more systematic about the game theory of these adaptive problems. So as a theory of morality, I have no objections to moral foundations theory. So the question was whether this sort of cynical view of political ideologies applies to moral systems as well. And maybe not. So, in the paper, I sort of take great pains to distinguish between politics and morality because I think they're too often conflated in a way that causes a lot of confusion. And the reason they're conflated is because politics almost always masquerades as morality in order to in order to achieve its political objectives. That is, in order to rally people to our side, we have to convince people that our side is the good side, the moral side, the virtuous side, and the other side is evil, unfair, disrespectful, etc. So morality is our chief weapon in our political arsenal, and that is why it is often so easy to confuse morality with politics as if they were the same thing. That is, to confuse moralism with morality. In the paper, I try to differentiate politics and morality in the following way. I describe politics as being centrally about conflict and loyalty to one or the other side of that conflict. That's what I think politics is ultimately about. And morality is ultimately about cooperation, that is, working together for a mutual benefit, and impartiality to either side of a conflict and working to resolve conflicts. So, in that sense, once you cleave politics from morality, morality starts to look pretty nice. So, in that sense, I don't think that morality, as distinguished from politics, can be described in the same sort of cynical terms as being about, self-interested flouting of moral principles. I think we do have genuine moral principles that are shared between liberals and conservatives. I think the prevailing view that ideologies are about moral disagreement is actually backwards. I think at the heart of our political disputes is moral agreement. That is, we are using the same moral language, the same moral intuitions to try to win political conflicts. We're trying to cast our side as the fair side, as the side for freedom, the side for patriotism, the side for compassion. And we couldn't have those political fights if both sides didn't care about compassion, freedom, fairness, etc. So I think we have common moral intuitions that partisans compete to activate, and that underlies a lot of our political discourse.
And so, again, if your theory is correct, would it have some implications as to how we look at correlations between individual differences and political beliefs, like, for example, certain differences in personality traits and particular political beliefs?
Sure, yeah. So a lot of people think that personality traits are the explanation for our political belief systems. I think that's wrong. But that doesn't mean that they don't matter and they don't exist. Clearly, there is some evidence that there are some personality differences between liberals and conservatives. There are some psychological differences between liberal conservatives. The question is, what role do they play? In my view, they play a secondary role to alliances. There are two ways that personality. The first way is that your psychological traits might predispose you to join certain alliances over others. That is, you might be inclined to side with people who are like you or who act in the interests of people who are like you. That's one possible mechanism. So, for example, if I am sexually restricted and uptight about sexual promiscuity, I might be more inclined to become religious. And if I'm more sexually promiscuous, I might be less inclined to become religious. I might abandon my religious upbringing. And of course, so there'd be a causal pathway between your sexual strategy, your religiosity, and your ideology. But ultimately, the religiosity is what's predicting the ideology, not the sexual strategy directly. I think. Or the sexual strategy is predicting loyalty to fellow sexually restricted people and wanting to advance their group interests. So that's one way. The other way is that the group you belong to or ally with shapes your personality or your psychological traits. There are plenty of ways you could see that. If you belong to a religious community, they're going to pressure you to behave in ways that mark you as a member of that religious community and distinguish you from other communities. They're going to want you to profess your devotion to the religion's creeds, to purge all doubts and uncertainties from your mind, to become more sexually restricted. So it might work the other way as well. So there are really two possible ways. So your personality might cause you to join certain alliances over others, or your alliance might shape your personality. And I think both of those mechanisms are compatible with alliance theory and compatible with the idea that alliances are ultimately the direct primary cause of our political beliefs.
And so your paper is all about a sort of new approach in political psychology, what you call there a shift from deep-seated moral values to ever-shifting alliances and rivalries. So before we move on from this topic to another one, I would like to ask you, so do you think that if you're correct, and if basically we told people about this, that when people get frustrated because, for example, from someone from their own political group, political party, for example, they find out that they have also alliances to some extent with people from other political ideologies, and they get very frustrated because, and they call them, for example, hypocrites or traitors or turncloaks or something like that. Do you think that it could help people perhaps be a little bit more understanding of where that behavior comes from, and perhaps also the fact that they probably also do that themselves, and I mean, perhaps be a little less divisive in their political approaches, or is that too optimistic?
I'm torn on that. I definitely think knowledge is a good thing, and knowledge of the truth might help us solve our problems, and in particular our political problems. Sometimes studying this makes me depressed and cynical and pessimistic. Sometimes I see a bit of a silver lining. I think one silver lining you might see is that this shows us that we're really not as different as we think we are. That we don't have these deep-seated worldviews that are completely clashing and at odds with one another. We don't have fundamentally different moral principles. We basically have the same moral principles. We all care about fairness. We all care about helping people who are truly in need. We all care about welcoming people into our group when they pose no threat and when they're willing to be an asset to our group. And the differences really come from our beliefs about those things, about what is unfair, what is fair, whether the people we want to welcome really are a threat or not, whether the people we want to help really are in need. Those are really what political differences are about. They're not about an absence or a presence of compassion, or an absence or a presence of a willingness to welcome people to the group, or an absence or a presence of concerns for fairness. So I think at the heart of our political disputes is a shared moral psychology, and I think that should challenge the idea that one side is inherently morally superior to the other side, at least in terms of their underlying character. Maybe their beliefs make them do things in the world that are bad, but in terms of their underlying character, their moral psychology, their intuitions, the way they interact with their family and their friends, most people are pretty decent people. And yeah, sometimes they can have beliefs that make them do terrible things, but I think it's worth remembering that we're not as different as we think we are.
Yeah, I was also perhaps thinking about the fact that if people understand that people's political beliefs and their own political beliefs are not so as coherent or consistent as they think, that perhaps when they, for example, see someone that identifies with their own political pole, political party, or something like that, espousing political beliefs that they don't necessarily agree with, that's not really the end of the world or a tragedy. It's just that, I mean, no one is fully consistent and no one follows, I don't know, a particular kind of political dogma to the last detail, so I don't know if that
Yeah, no,
makes sense.
that's a good point. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I guess the idea is that you might be less pissed off by the traitors on your side once you realize that your side is just a cobbled together patchwork of inconsistent beliefs. That if you think that your side has a coherent, principled moral philosophy, and you see someone deviating from that, well, then you might think that they're evil or insane or stupid. Right, but if you see your side as not having a coherent or principled philosophy, then you might be a little bit softer on people who might deviate from it, because if they're deviating from it, maybe they're deviating from it in a good way. Yeah, that's one hopeful way of looking at it. I'm not optimistic about political extremists being softened by these ideas, but I think it might affect people who are a bit more moderate at the margins.